From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear from UW-Milwaukee's Chancellor Mark Mone about how the university is planning for the future and how it's dealing with the fallout from this pandemic. Then we continue our conversation on how Indigenous people have coped with the coronavirus and past pandemics.
One thing that we have to take a look at is how did these poverty conditions be created, and you can trace that back to when we were forced onto reservations during Indian removal in the 1830s.
Plus, we learn about Wisconsin's many state symbols and icons with Milwaukee Records' Tyler Moss.
There's nearly three dozen symbols that we have actually literally filed the paperwork, and we put in the effort to declare this one thing as the most important in our state.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The first semester of college under COVID-19 is over. Now, schools have the difficult task of planning for the future. College leaders are deciding whether the benefits of holding in-person classes outweigh the risks of coronavirus exposure. University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Chancellor Mark Mone says he will announce plans for the fall semester in June. Beyond the question of reopening campus, UWM is facing a projected $50 to $100 million deficit by the end of the next school year. WUWM education reporter Emily Files spoke with Mone about the challenges ahead. She starts by asking about a polarizing proposal from UW System President Ray Cross. Cross's blueprint for the future would require the state's 11 comprehensive universities to identify programs that could be cut to save money. Emily asks Chancellor Mone about his reaction to this proposal.
You know, I think there's some truth to what President Cross is talking about, that the sustainability question is facing all of higher education right now. There's more universities than there are students to go to them. So we do need to have additional revenue sources. We do need to look at alternative audiences. With respect to the comprehensives, I can't speak to that. That's something that I know President Cross is working on and has designated some priorities. A couple of comments pertaining to UW-Milwaukee and how we're approaching that same scenario, because you could make an argument that the factors, all the things that made us who we are not going to be the same things that are going to be important for the future. What got us here won't get us there type of idea. And I think that the blueprint thinking is something that we've already been aligned with. We're looking right now, what are the strongest programs? Where are enrollment projections likely to be? We're involved in that same type of process already, and I think that is critically important for us to do. The one aspect of the blueprint that I've had discussion with President Cross about, I know that our provost has been engaged with folks at the system level, is around the way that online programs are going to be looked at in the future. I think that's the third pillar of the blueprint, and we want to make sure that given our investments and given what we have achieved, the national rankings in many of our programs for our online programs, the types of partnerships that we have with, whether it's the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute with Marquette or other programs, we want to have that autonomy to continue to have our brand and the programmatic quality. Are there opportunities for collaboration? Yes. But I think that, this is something the system does have to look at. Final comment on the blueprint is that I think that at some point the regents will be looking at approving or not approving that or certain aspects of it. And I think that will happen down the road. I don't think that's going to happen in June. That was originally the plan, that there would be discussion and then potentially approval. I think that has been pushed down. So there'll be time to sort this out. I also think President Cross put a pretty ambitious timeline out there. And so that's gonna be interesting to see how that will play out.
So since UWM is not one of the 11 comprehensive institutions, institutions. My understanding is that it's not necessarily, if this blueprint were to go forward, it wouldn't be asked to make the same decisions about programming and its mission, kind of narrowing its focus, that the other universities might be asked to do. But you mentioned that UWM has been thinking about its programs. So could downsizing the number of majors or departments at the school be in UWM's future?
Well, I think it has been already. We've been doing that over time, and I think that will continue. What are areas that continue to remain strong? What are areas that just don't continue to have some of the enrollments or some of the elements that we can't maintain?
How far down the road would those decisions be?
So hypothetically, for example, if we come back and we're at 90% of our current enrollments, and that's all online, that's one financial scenario that has huge implications because we don't have the revenue for our residence halls, dining, parking, segregated fees. So we, at that point, if we get into the fall, the good news here is we've got some reserves. So we don't have to make, hard decisions immediately about programmatic areas. But I think you may know, we were already planning, independent of the pandemic, we were looking at an $8 to $10 million operating deficit for this year, that we were making plans next year for tightening our belt in a number of ways. Now that has ballooned to between 18 and 20. Right now, that's the end of this year. So in the fall, depending on what happens, that's one path and scenario we'd lay out where we might have to start looking at some of those decisions timeline. If on the other hand, we have students back on campus, let's say 40% of our students or 50% are in the residence halls, and we have more face-to-face classes, and the spring is even better, a vaccine occurs, or society has just said, we're going to drive through this, we have to overcome that, then we can push back some of those decisions. So it's very much contingent on how the scenarios play out, what enrollments occur, what additional types of support we get from Congress, from the state legislature, or the governor through additional federal funding. So there's a lot of unknowns in terms of when those types of decisions would be made.
And we'll get back to some of those possibilities about what the fall and spring semester might look like. But let's talk about the financial impact that UWM is currently experiencing and expected to experience. In your presentation to the Board of Regents a couple of weeks ago, you said the impact of the pandemic on UWM was catastrophic and that higher education is in peril. Tell me more about why you used that strong language to describe the situation.
Yeah, this isn't just pulling concepts and themes and phrases out of thin air. Every day, I'm reviewing articles today about the campuses across the country that have furloughed, laid off, considering closure. We saw in Wisconsin the first private college with an announcement that they'll be closing. My alma mater, Central Washington University, declared financial exigency. I'm seeing campuses across the country where the terms existential are thrown about routinely. This is something that had been happening before the pandemic. You have to understand there's a lot of challenges with a financial model that supports higher education actually broke a long time ago. And today, I have colleagues in New Jersey that are experiencing immediately a 25% state budget reduction. We had for this year alone a 5% budget cut. Next year, in the same biennial budget year, we may well face the same. We certainly hope not. We want further investment. But when you have public institutions that are receiving cuts almost immediately, and you have major questions about enrollment declines, I think there's no other way to describe this than catastrophic.
You mentioned the 5% state budget cut in the current fiscal year, which is the next month and a half. And the brunt of that is being borne by the UW system. That means an about $6.5 million reduction for UWM. Is that right?
That's right.
How are you pulling that off?
Well, you know, what that does, and your point is right on, we have a month and a half, So the expenses have already occurred. I mean, you can't save that money in this kind of time frame. So the reality is it deepens the hole. And so that's factored into the projections that we have for this year. And with our reserves, it will just deepen how far we have to go into those. I think you have perhaps heard, you know, we are looking at, immediately we went into a furlough mode, two different types of furloughs, those that are both through the summer. For a number of our employees that can't do work remotely, or they can do work remotely, but they're just not essential, or we need to save the funds. Then next month, we start with what's called the intermittent furloughs or the across the board furloughs. Those will affect all employees that aren't already furloughed. So we're looking at where we can save funds. We have not laid people off. At this point, we are trying to trim everything that's non-essential. We also have to look at alternative revenue possibilities. And so we're pursuing a number of online new types of programs. They're not only academic, but a lot of non-credit. We can't just continue to cut. We really do need to think about alternative ways to build recruitment, to fill that next class, and so forth.
So for the current fiscal year, state cut, your UWM is basically pulling from reserves and going to have to factor that into the upcoming fiscal year's deficit.
Exactly.
Okay. And you also told the regions that UWM is facing a between $50 and $100 million deficit by the end of next fiscal year?
That's right. That's modeled on us having about a 10% enrollment decline and some limitations to the number of people that are on campus.
So let's talk about fall semester. Summer classes are entirely online. What options are you considering for the fall, and what do you think is the most likely scenario?
Oh, that's a good question. That's the campus question across the world right now. And no matter what we plan, I'll just say this as a, you know, two caveats before any answers. One is, we're not in this alone. You know, I'll note right now, we have extremes out there where you have the Cal State system that has declared last week their fall will be exclusively or largely online. Meanwhile, you've got University of Arizona, Purdue, University of Florida, I heard Texas A&M, you know, others that are very large. They are saying, we are going to be open. We are going to be here face to face. We are right now studying our options. And so my second caveat, one is that we're not in this alone. Second one is we haven't made a decision yet. So we are looking at really different scenarios that include one path being we just have to go completely online. We continue doing what we're doing. The second one is we're going to have face-to-face as much as possible with some online supplement. And then the model in between has all sorts of variations where we might start face-to-face, have some online that then we revert more if there's a surge or a spike. As far as the most likely, that's a crystal ball I don't have. I don't know with certainty. My hunch is we'll have an awful lot online, and we're going to try to, as safely as possible, bring people back for some face-to-face types of activities. We and others this summer are piloting practicum, clinical experiences, doing some things where there'll be some limited activities face to face. That will be a test. We'll see what happens. But the most likely scenario is just fraught with so many unknowns right now. It's hard to even say. I'd like to make a decision by mid-June about what we'll do, and we'll go public at that point with, here's our path, here's what we're planning on doing. Along the way, we want to put in place a lot of safety protocol if we do go down that face-to-face path.
What kind of precautions would the university take if classes were back in person to some degree?
So there's a lot of things that we're looking at right now, and they would include, whatever is, if you will, state of the art at that time. I've been on calls with folks from System and Exact Sciences as one model of looking at the testing protocol, what would be involved. And we're looking at how can we have something that's economical, that's easy, that works out so that we can do, if necessary, batching and pooled sampling. So that may be something that we do. I don't know if college campuses by late August, early September will be doing that. as much as just something that's involved with temperature checks, tracing, and so forth. So those are foundational pieces, the testing and tracing. So we're exploring that. Then we have to think about, if you have somebody who's positive, what kind of separation, isolation, you know, would you have quarantine areas? If you have international students that have arrived, you can't just send them home if they're positive. So what are the things that provide protection, isolation, if you have that? As you know, UWM is a highly porous community, meaning that about 80% of our students live off campus. So there's a lot of people who travel off and on campus. We can't begin to control those behaviors, those environments, neighborhoods, practices outside of campus. So we have to recognize that PPE is going to be very important. Protocol around masks and having requirements and agreements that people, in terms of social distancing, how we would have classrooms set up in certain ways, how we would have entrances and exits. But again, nothing is decided yet. We don't know. But those are some of the dimensions that would be involved. I think behaviorally, as we think about students 18 to 25 years old, you have some training and communication that's very important. And I think there's aspects from almost a public health program, kind of, you know, the communication and the awareness. We can do all these great things on campus, but what if people go to Brady Street and enjoy bar activity in life that's not as socially distant, and then they come back to campus? Or, you know, how do you enforce, how do you monitor? So there's going to have to be a whole new mindset. And again, it's awareness, it's training, it's something that's a world we haven't encountered, but we're thinking through all those types of things. So I think those are the examples of practices we would have in place should we go down that path, which is our goal right now, to have a safe campus, the safest possible campus that we can.
If UWM does go entirely or mostly online, how would that affect tuition?
That's also being looked at right now. What we did this summer is we found a middle ground where students don't experience a lot of the things that normally seg fees would enable a student to have, you know, a lot of the different physical aspects, Clatchy Center or the types of child care support and other types of things. So we've modified that, but we're also providing more support and resources online than for students that they normally wouldn't have. So with the Student Association, we've found a middle ground. I imagine we'd look at that in the fall as well. You know, we're hearing from parents and students, and they're asking a lot of questions about this as well, because there may be an expectation that we bought, or historically we paid this much for this type of experience. You're providing something that we see as different. Some would say less. I don't know if that's necessarily true across the board. But if we can't fulfill that, we have to look at the price compression, the pressure that is on there. And then no matter what we do, there's also the rest of the world. If they reduce their prices and we don't, that, you know, again, that's one of those uncontrollable factors. So we'll have to see what happens in that front.
You mentioned that some of the financial planning, you're using a 90% enrollment compared to previous years. So how is enrollment looking? Is there any indication yet whether UWM might benefit from more Milwaukee area students wanting to stay closer to home?
The numbers that I see today, and I'll just pull a couple of things out. Just looked at some enrollment reports. Overall, we're down. You put all this together, we're down about 7.6%. So that's the projections right now. And we have some surprises in there, some good news. Masters and doctoral students up, online up. Our branch campuses, the UWM at Waukesha, UWM at Washington County, those are doing really well. They're strong. But where we're seeing the drop off is, of course, freshmen down right now about 5%. Our transfer students down about 15%. But overall, 7.6 as of today. And to your question, I hope that does happen. The concept of, you know, gap years, where people don't want to go out of state and pay $40,000-$50,000 a year. Why not stay here, continue your credit bearing semesters, really build on that opportunity, and along the way, find out just how good the education quality is here at UW-Milwaukee.
Is there anything else that you want to add?
I obviously, through this interview, you've heard about my concerns, the things that keep me up at night and where we're going. But I would end by saying I'm very, very confident that we have the best people working on ways to bring people back in a way that continues the education, that is as safe as we realistically can enact. And I'm pretty optimistic about the future of UW-Milwaukee.
Mark Mone is Chancellor of UW-Milwaukee, and he spoke with education reporter Emily Files. WUWM is a broadcast service of UWM. Coming up, we hear about challenges to Indigenous sovereignty amid the coronavirus. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Yesterday on Lake Effect, we heard how Wisconsin's Oneida Indian Nation is turning to Indigenous agricultural practices in order to put food on the table during the coronavirus pandemic and recession. But how did that resilient, self-reliant attitude become such a hallmark of American Indian life? Lake Effect's Julian Heider recently caught up with an Indigenous historian, Heather Briegel, to discuss some of the pretext, viral and otherwise, for how America's First Nations live today.
Heather Briegel, thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Yeah, not a problem.
So I think a lot of people think of 1492 as the seminal moment when Christopher Columbus brought disease to the Americas. A lot of people kind of invoke that as a very traumatic time because a lot of Indigenous people were killed at that moment. But that's not the whole picture. What are some of the things that people miss in that 500-year span?
Yeah, so I guess while we're in school, you know, we do hear 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It's funny that that's the first thing that you start with. I have a t-shirt from a Native-owned company that says Native history started before 1492. So I always like to let people know, you know, we were here before that. But obviously 1492 is the pivotal point where, you know, we are having contact with colonists or explorers who are coming in to the Americas. And with them, they did bring disease, unfortunately. And because we were so isolated, you know, on Turtle Island for such a long, long time, centuries.
Turtle Island being North America?
The Americas. Yep, the Americas, North America. We didn't have those immunities built up to the diseases that were brought over. And one of the big diseases that we hear about is smallpox. And smallpox took a major toll on the Native communities, you know, when it was first introduced from European settlers, colonists, colonizers, what have you. And it struck New England really hard in 1633. And much of the New England Indians were virtually wiped out. They went from a population that was around 16,000, if you combine the Mohegan and the Pequot populations, down to 3,000. So it was incredible the way that the disease spread through the Native nations. And, you know, so it started in New England and it would just slowly work its way across the United States, down to the Southeast tribes, the Great Lakes tribes, out to the West. And, you know, you hear those jokes about Native people given blankets, you know, with, you know, smallpox in them, you know, on them. Those necessarily weren't jokes. I mean, that actually happened. So, you know, facing pandemics in the past is not anything that's new to Native America. It's more detrimental to us and our Native nations, but it is something we've had to deal with in the past, whether it was that smallpox, you know, first being brought over, or even, you know, the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918.
Yeah, you noted something, and I was hoping you could expand on it a little bit, about predisposition. So there's a lot of conversation right now about immunity, right? You mentioned smallpox. There was a vaccine developed for that. But the idea of minority communities, American Indian communities, Black and Latinx communities being predisposed to heart disease. Some people say that's connected to poverty. How has the coronavirus kind of discourse played in American Indigenous communities with regards to those health effects that have existed for a long time?
So we do know that with coronavirus, those that are more susceptible to it are in a certain age bracket. So whether that is, I believe it's 60 and older. And then we also know that the other groups of people that are more susceptible to coronavirus, particularly in the underlying health conditions of heart disease and diabetes, those two things run rampant in Indian country. Diabetes rates amongst Native people versus non-Native people is much higher. Heart disease rates amongst Native people versus non-Native people is also much higher. And those can be attributed to, I know you'd mentioned some people say that it's attributed to poverty. It very, it can be attributed to that. But one thing that we have to take a look at is how did these poverty conditions be created? And you can trace that back to when we were forced onto reservations during Indian removal in the 1830s.
I was hoping you could expand on some of that. Like, yeah. I think people know about Indian casinos. Maybe people drive to reservations to fill up their gas tanks. There's a lot of kind of economic life on reservations that has slowed down, and through some of that historical legislation has proven to be a bit of a double-edged sword in terms of the economic life that Indigenous people are able to have.
It truly has. I know across the country and even here in Wisconsin, your tribal casinos are not operating right now. I work for the Stockbridge Muncie community, and our tribal casino has been shut down since March 21st. It is still shut down and will remain so through at least May 26th, when the original Safer at Home order was to expire. If you have a successful tribal casino, that is where most of your tribal revenue comes from. And those being shut down has a huge impact on the financial stability of a tribe, no matter how large or small you are. The Stockbridge Muncie community is a smaller community, say compared to the Oneida community of Wisconsin, which is a larger community. But we're going to still have, both tribes are still going to have economic impacts that are going to take years to recover from. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult to see what happens, you know, the rest of this year, 2020, going into 2021 and 2022, to see how we, you know, recover. But if history has taught us anything, as I said earlier, as a people, we are resilient and we will come back from this.
It's very interesting how that seems to reveal some of the difficult aspects of maintaining tribal sovereignty. I mean, on one hand, you want to have self-determination as a sovereign nation, but on the other hand, it's difficult to live out like a economically self-sustaining life without needing to depend on things like a casino. So how does that trade-off play out historically? The urge to, for example, leave a nation, assimilate into culture because it provides for economic opportunities versus staying with your nation, sovereign as it is, but in a difficult situation in a moment of crisis like this?
Right. No, that's a great question. I myself personally was not born on a reservation. I wasn't raised on a reservation. I am an enrolled citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin and a first-line descendant Stockbridge Muncie, but I was not raised on either reservation. I was raised in the city. I played on concrete jungles and things like that. And the only time we ever visited the reservation when I was growing up was during powwow or to visit family or what have you. Even though I wasn't born on a reservation, I knew with the gifts that I received in the outside world and my education, I needed to come back and help, you know, further along the causes of my people. And I think that's what a lot of people think about when they leave, the reservation to come back. Yes, we are sovereign and we carry that with us no matter where we are, but we do know, and the people who live on the reservation do understand, that there are economic hardships that can't always be fixed right there.
That's very interesting. It certainly reflects a diaspora experience, even though it is still very local. So that's very interesting to hear. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Heather Briegel. She's an Indigenous historian and writer who runs cultural affairs for the Stockbridge Munsee Band of the Mohican Indians in Wisconsin. I wanted to pull a little bit more of that thread of sovereignty. I saw that originally two tribes in Wisconsin have agreed to follow Governor Evers Seyfert home orders. That's the Oneida, which you mentioned earlier. The Menominee Nation did as well. But in other places like South Dakota, there has been a little bit of a standoff between the Sioux tribes and the state over access in and out of their reservations. So I'm wondering, like, when it comes to sovereignty and protecting health, how does that depend on where you are in the country?
I think if you are in an area of the country where, with your state leadership, you have a good relationship with them, they understand where you are, you understand where they are, your state leadership understands what sovereignty is, your state leadership understands that they're not dealing with an ethnic group, they are dealing with a nation within a nation, I think then your relationship is good. And I think what you are able to accomplish is good.
South Dakota has had plenty of flashpoints, hasn't it, with between Indigenous communities and the government?
Yes, it has been. I think here in Wisconsin, it's safe to say that the relationship between the tribal nations and the state leadership, particularly the governor, is good. I think there is some issue within, like, our state, I think in Wisconsin, they're called assembly people. So, like, your state senators or your state representatives, I think depending on where you are, it could be a little different. I think in areas of the country where there have been contentious issues historically, I think that's where it gets a little bit difficult. And I think that's where we're running into issues in South Dakota. The South Dakota governor is a Republican, and this is not her first run-in with the tribes in South Dakota where she's had issues. And I think there's a huge lack of understanding of Indian law and Indian history, where I feel like that gets lost in translation, where people just think, oh, well, you can do this or you can do that. Well, no, you can't, because we have laws in place or we have treaties in place that say the state, you're overstepping your boundaries. I think that lack of education in Indian history and Indian law plays a huge effect on how the relationship is between tribal nations, state government, and federal government.
Well, I think some people might be surprised, especially people who might not be following tribal issues as closely as someone who's enrolled in a nation such as yourself, that the colonization of certain nations and the disregard for certain treaties persists well into the 21st century in some cases.
Yes, it does. I mean, we just have to look at what happened at Standing Rock with the Dakota Access Pipeline. We just have to look at what happens with the Keystone XL Pipeline. We have to just look and see what happens, or you just need to look and see what happens with an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and the lack of federal and state help in regards to that epidemic. Look what's happening now with this COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, there is I mean, and even as this is going on, there's a case in the Supreme Court of the United States right now that is arguing whether or not reservations actually exist in the state of Oklahoma. So we are constantly having to fight for our own sovereignty. We have to fight to make people aware of our history, and we have to fight to make people honor our treaties. So it's a constant battle.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That Oklahoma case is also very interesting. I encourage people to Google it.
Yes.
If it goes through, as some of the people hope that it does, much of Tulsa will be under tribal authority, which would be very interesting for the people of Tulsa, very different than what it is now.
It would basically be the eastern half of Oklahoma.
Yeah, yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting to see some of that playing out. Now, we've talked a little bit about the negative, about the kind of, benign neglect that happens out of convenience sometimes with indigenous groups and tribal nations. Tell me a bit about some of the positive. What is some of the solidarity that happens between Indian groups, and also solidarity between Native American tribes and other nations, ethnic groups that have faced colonization and hunger?
Yeah, so in spite of all of this that is happening, there are definitely some bright spots and positive things happening. I've seen communities come together, Native communities come together to help each other, to help other Native communities. I was actually just on social media, which I'm on a lot during this pandemic, but I saw in the weeks since it started, there were people in different Native groups in the state of Wisconsin who were getting together and making masks to send to the Navajo Nation, where we know they are hit really hard right now with over 3,000 cases of COVID-19. We see in the Stockbridge Muncie community, our elders who are at home right now, people in the community have gotten together to put together goodie bags, you know, for them, little snacks and, essential items such as, cleaning supplies and things like that. So that has happened. You've had some non-Native groups who have come in to help the Native nations. And one of the groups that has actually stepped in is the Irish. And the people in Ireland, if you're not familiar with your Irish history, suffered a really horrible famine back in the 1800s, the potato famine. And of course, it hit that country extremely hard, and it was devastating to them. Well, nobody wants to see anybody ever go hungry. So we had a couple groups of Native people here in the United States actually send money over to the Irish to help them during this time. And one of the groups was the Choctaw Nation, who are now, they were displaced from their home in Southeast United States to Indian Territory, which was Oklahoma in 1831. And they, it was a few years after they were displaced, they sent money to the Irish, and they didn't have a lot to send. But they were like, it's our job. It's our job to help them. And with the passing of the CARES Act this year during the COVID-19 pandemic, there was money that was set aside for Native nations, but it's been very slow to get out to the Native nations here in the United States. Well, the Irish got wind of this, and they started, of all things, a GoFundMe page. And they've
raised... No kidding.
A GoFundMe page, of all things. And they've raised, last I checked, was $1.9 million. And this was to pay back a kindness that was done to them during their time of need. And so this money will be distributed to the Navajo and Hopi nations, who are being hit extremely hard by the pandemic right now. And it's, if you read some of the comments on the GoFundMe page that people have posted, or even just reading news articles about it, when asked why are they doing this, and the Irish who were also a colonized people, which a lot of times I think people forget, but the English did colonize them as well. And their response to helping out to the Native nations in the United States is they're our brethren. They helped us in our time of need. It's the least we can do to help them. So to pay 170-year-old kindness of $170, this GoFundMe page has raised almost $1.9 million right now.
That's really incredible. And
yeah,
I mean, it's inspiring, but it also shows where the gaps are in terms of how people are served. So that's very, very interesting. Thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect, Heather.
Oh, thank you.
That was Heather Briegel, an Indigenous historian and writer who runs cultural affairs for the Stockbridge Munsee Band of the Mohican Indians in Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. As mentioned during the interview, shuttered casinos are challenging the economic independence of many tribes. Since this interview was recorded, the Oneida Nation announced they will be reopening their casino on May 26th. Social distancing, protective equipment, and other precautions will be enforced. After a short break, we'll learn about some of Wisconsin's lesser-known state symbols. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Many of us have been playing board games and doing puzzles to keep busy. Online trivia has also become more popular. So imagine you get a question about Wisconsin's state animal. That seems like an easy enough question, especially if you grew up here. And if you answered the badger, you're right. That is the official Wisconsin state animal. But here's your follow-up question. What seven other animals hold titles? Milwaukee Record's Tyler Moss didn't know either, so he started digging through various state archives and discovered an entire world of state symbols and icons he hadn't known about. He wrote about his findings for Milwaukee Record in 2019, and he spoke with me about what he found then.
I happened to be in Michigan. I was there visiting some friends, and then they had like a mug at their house that had like these really obscure symbols, just these really hyper-specific things. So when I got home, like the first thing I did was look at all the Wisconsin ones. We have like roughly 30 symbols and icons and things like that. A lot are in the animal kingdom. There's about four or five in the food realm. And you realize like, oh, I've been living my whole life with the knowledge that the badger was the animal, but there's actually like seven animals. There's a dog for the state, the water spaniel, I believe it is. There's a wildlife animal, which I thought the badgers were based in the wildlife, but it's apparently the white-tailed deer.
Yeah, you'd think a badger is wild.
Yeah, there's also a fish, the muskellunge, a.k.a. the muskie, if you're informal like that. There's actually the robin, as a lot of people know. I grew up with that knowledge, at least, that the robin is our bird. But then there's another bird, the mourning dove, the symbol of peace. And so like, while it's a bird, it also works this way as a symbol of peace. I don't really know any other symbols of peace, though.
A robin is not peaceful. Like, they're pretty peaceful birds.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're a worm.
Unless you're a worm. Yeah, that's true. So, yeah, there are a number of these different state animals, as you mentioned. We have the badger, which, of course, we know of ourselves as the badger state. Mm-hmm. But then, yes, the white-tailed deer, the muskie, mourning dove, American robin. One of the interesting ones I thought was the honeybee, in part because it's not actually native.
That's very strange, yeah.
Like, you could have gone with a mud wasp. I don't know. You could have gone with a bunch of other different insects that would have been.
Yeah, or the mosquito.
Mosquito. That's,
which if you ask like certain people, that's the bird of our state.
Basically, yeah.
That's like a dad joke.
So food and drink, contentious category. And what's perhaps most surprising is our official beverage is not beer.
Yeah, it's milk. I wonder if there was a milk board sort of like push, if that was an invented like new category. Because, yeah, obviously it would be beer because our rich like, you know, brewing history. And the fact that it's what we're known for, like, outside of our borders. And no, it's milk. I'm not sure how that's working now with all the dairies that are going under, unfortunately, but it's at least immortalized as the Wisconsin state beverage for some reason.
Well, and a lot of these aren't that surprising. I guess what is surprising is that we have a state pastry, Kringle. It's the Kringle.
Yeah, I wonder why that is the case. I wonder if they have that like in Wyoming or insert any other state, if there's like this renowned like local pastry.
Inside of food and drink, we have the state fruit and the state grain.
Yeah, like I might be really dumb, but I didn't realize it was a grain. I don't know, corn. It's a grain. I don't know. I figured it would just be like wheat or something. And obviously the fruit is?
Cranberries.
Yes.
I didn't know this for a long time, that we made that many cranberries.
Yeah, I realized we were a very vast producer, I suppose. But I didn't realize that we were number one by like a long shot.
Huge. Yeah, we supply half the world's supply of cranberries.
Yeah, the bogs are in all the tourism ads. You see Donald Driver messing around with the dudes in the cranberry bog.
There are some state symbols that I think everybody knows. Badger is an obvious one, and then on Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Also, the motto, I would say, is relatively obvious. It's in the song On Wisconsin, actually, that being forward.
You have a whole category of things that you've called the so-called underground icons. These symbols actually truly do make Wisconsin the state it is. It's literally what Wisconsin's about.
Yeah, it's the bedrock of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Red granite is the official rock of our state. There is a place, actually, red granite, that you've maybe jumped off of some high ledges into water there. It's in northeast Wisconsin, I believe, red granite. The mineral is apparently galena, which I think is a city in Illinois, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a city in Illinois. Do you think it's named for our state mineral?
Maybe they just also have it and they decided they maybe beat us to the punch.
That's more likely. Yeah.
And then the Antigo silt loam, that's the official soil.
I don't even know exactly what that is.
I know that Antigo is a place in northern Wisconsin, and apparently silt loam must be really prevalent there.
They have amazing silt loam.
Yeah.
I mean, so amazing that it became representative of our entire state.
Yeah, and I even looked for more examples of, like, what's another soil type for my article, and it's just, like, loam. We're very loam-rich here.
All right, nice. Well, you know, then you have to represent the loam.
Mm-hmm. No clay, I guess, or not much. Not enough?
Not enough. Not enough.
Not enough clay.
The fossil I thought was interesting, it's a trilobite. Were there a lot of trilobites in Wisconsin?
I think that might be another one of those instances, like the mourning dove, where, I mean, how many fossils are out there? I looked for more examples to be like, okay, is a mollusk that? I think that's actually a sort of trilobite. I don't know.
Does every state have its own fossil? Like, I just want to know who the fossil lobbyist is.
Yeah, big trilobite.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Big trilobite out there being like, hey, Wisconsin, you know what you need? State fossil.
Yeah, no trilobite, doulabite.
The other one, actually, I did know the state flower.
The wood violet?
Wood violet, yeah.
Okay, I guess I did too, because this was one of the rare times where I didn't have to look at my notes. So, yeah, the wood violet, I believe it's vaguely purplish, yeah, as the name would suggest.
And then the tree, the state tree is?
Yeah, the sugar maple, which I guess there's a bar here in, actually, Bayview named the Sugar Maple, which it's a very fitting name because it sort of has that, like, Wisconsin-y kind of vibe, and it's, I didn't realize it was honoring the official tree of our state.
Yeah, who knew? Yeah, so you came upon one symbol that we talked about a little bit before we started recording. It's a huge thing in Scotland, but not so much in the United States.
After looking up the name tartan, it's a woolen cloth, and it's apparently very popular in Scotland, as you said, and I'm not sure of the breakdown of the population of Scots that live here, but enough to warrant us having the Wisconsin tartan as our official tartan. I don't really know if any other place had a shot, but it's blue and green, and that's all. I think there's a little bit of red worked in.
It's a kind of a what I would call plaid, I guess, but
yeah, you might accidentally be repping it already. If you are hanging out at a Northwoods bar in the suburbs or whatever, you might unconsciously displaying your regional pride. And you should at least look into it too. You don't want to be accidentally wearing the Illinois one or something.
No, God no.
Yeah, what would you do?
You'd be a fib. When you take them all together, what do you think what do you think it's saying about Wisconsin? What's the story here?
I think at one point it was a nod to the wildlife here, which is, I mean, very much there still. Then along the way, there's some other things where we're like, oh, we didn't realize that we happen to like this one weird pastry and no one else really knows about it or does it. So it's ours. Just the fact that it's like, this is our official animal, but this is our official domestic animal. This is our official fish and bird. This is a different bird that is more of a symbol of peace, but it's also a bird. And then we have a wildlife animal because the state animal, though it lives in the wildlife, is not a wildlife animal. We just have to get the deer in there somehow. So, yeah, it's very strange that there are all these like different symbols. There's nearly 36 symbols that we have actually literally filed the paperwork and we put in the effort and, as you said before, the lobbying to declare this one thing as the most important in our state. The emblem we want others to know is our official one. We deem this to be the tree. We need you to know the sugar maple is number one in our hearts. I think it's a mixture of we kind of arrive upon some local pride, and then it's also the awareness of the local amenities and the attractions and like the literal minerals and the animals that sort of make us this very special and distinct area.
Yeah. Well, Tyler, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and talking to me about the state.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Tyler Moss is one of the co-founders of Milwaukee Record. I spoke to him in September 2019. You'll find a link to his article on the lesser-known Wisconsin state symbols, as well as other conversations with Milwaukee Record at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.